This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Maybe it's the people, maybe it's the geography, but North Carolina is the setting for a good share of ghost stories. Out in the western part of the state, there are the often just a tad too quiet mountain hollers. And in the east, equally remote swamps. And don't let's forget about the haunted pirate ships. Well, writer and musician Bland Simpson recounts tales of the North Carolina coast in the musical production King Mackerel and the Blues Are Running, and over the years he has stumbled upon a native ghost story or two, and Bland Simpson joins us on this Halloween. Hi there, Bland.
Hi, Melinda. How you doing?
Hi, welcome to the program again.
Thank you.
Well, and if you care to share any of your ghostly North Carolina stories, our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Well, Bland, what's the best North Carolina ghost story you've come across?
Oh, that's like choosing between children, Melinda. there are a lot of great ones from the mountains to the coast. Blackbeard is supposed to be a spirit. Nellwise Wechter made him into Teach's Light. He died in a rather dramatic fashion by getting multiple stab wounds and gunshots and having his head lopped off and put on a bowsprit. So he was a good candidate to become an immediate ghost.
He had some issues going out, eh?
Yes, yeah. And of course he haunts us still because his ship, we believe, has been found just off Beaufort mm-hmm. Bar there, and I would say that his spirit still is at large, making people concerned about the treasure he supposedly sank and all that. Mm-hmm. Up in the mountains, the Brown Mountain Lights, there's a great Ghost of the Old Mine story from Gold Hill, the old Reed Mine there, down near Charlotte. A big bully killed a weaker man because the weaker man had won the heart of the woman they were both interested in, and the ghost of the weaker man, though, came back and lowered the elevator down into the mine, and it wasn't there when the big bully went to work the next day, and down he went 700 feet, and the ghost of the old mine got him.
All right. It says payback kind of stories.
Yeah. ghosts with revenge, with matters to settle, they're pretty strong characters.
Well, if you could refresh my memory on the Brown Mountain Lights, I know that is the name of a band right now in central North Carolina, but the story behind that is?
Well, it's one of these inexplicable collections of lights. I don't know what the explanation is. I mean, they're just supposedly ghost lights, and nobody can explain them. And there are many of them. But we have I mentioned Teach's Light earlier. We have the Mako Light, the ghost of Mako Station, down about 14 miles west of Wilmington. And there was an Okisco Light down in Pasquotank County. So ghost lights seem to be a pretty popular matter, who and what they represent, though.
And when you're saying lights here, you're not talking about a lighthouse for navigation for a person like Blackbeard. You're talking about lights that just appear.
Lights that appear and move around or appear and lure people closer and then vanish and that kind of thing. The Mako Light is probably one of my favorites. So Jim Wan and I wrote a song about it that's in King Mackerel. That's the story of from the late 1860s, where a brakeman on a caboose, the caboose gets loose from the train, and there's a second train coming up behind it, and he goes to the rear of the caboose and waves his lantern, trying to warn the second train and keep a wreck from occurring. But he fails, and the second train runs up on him, and there's a big collision, and the brakeman, Joe Baldwin by name, is decapitated, and his lantern flies off into the swamp, and for years, really for a century thereafter, there was a light seen along the tracks, a spectral light along that area that was nicknamed immediately the Mako Light, after the name of the station. And I saw a light down there, but thousands and thousands of North Carolinians have gone down to Mako Station and sat there for hours on end of a night to see if they could see it.
So what did the light look like to you?
The one I saw, and I have no idea, I've been very careful to say I saw a light at Mako Station. I don't know if I saw the Mako light, but it looked like a match. I mean, the light in a kerosene lantern, you didn't, there was no light match flare. It just appeared as a flickering flame down the tracks. And there were 40 people there watching on this particular autumn night, and they all saw it. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, there was no question about whether a light was down there. Now, what the source of it was, I'll never know.
Because, I mean, a skeptic could say, well, if 40 people were assembled there, somebody might feel it necessary to, you know, show them a little light.
You know, it may be like the old Phantom comic strip. It passes from generation to generation. Somebody who lives in the neighborhood has to go out there and, you know, keep it going, do the light.
Now, do you consider yourself especially suggestible about, you know, about ghosts and then you would see things?
No, not particularly. I just thought, you know, like everybody else, I always thought the stories were fun and, you know, campfire kind of lore, the stuff that would, if you listened, if you really got into the tale whoever was telling, you might get yourself properly scared and then be able to pass it on.
Right, right. Well, you wrote a few years ago about a ship that was called a ghost ship, the mystery of the Carolee Deering, Charles Deering. What, remind us about that story again. This was a ship that went down at Diamond Shoals off the North Carolina coast.
Yes, it the Deering came in. It was a five-masted schooner, came in on the night of January 31st of 1921, and was seen by the watch first thing in the morning, that Monday morning, out in the mists, you know, a good 8 or 10 miles out there on the outer diamond of those shoals, and all sails were set, and the men tried to get out, the lifesavers, Coast Guardsmen, tried to get out to her, and they couldn't get anywhere near her, couldn't even read the name on the ship. It was several days before the seas settled down, but they could see that there was, appeared to be nobody on the vessel, even though all the sails were set, and they couldn't figure out why had there been no rescue, you know, flare, call for rescue. But when they finally were able to board the ship at the end of that week, they found, you know, there was food in a pan on the galley stove and the plates on the table, and so the story that came forth was when rescuers got there, there was hot food on the table, and as if the crew had just vanished like ghosts over the side. In fact, it was 4 days between the sighting on Monday and the boarding on Friday, and it was early February, so there's no possibility there was hot food on the table. But it's a much better story. It's in fireside, you know, terms for it to have been hot food. But they never did find the crew. The crew.
That's right. They do call it ghost stories, not ghost reporting, after all.
Yes. Much better that way.
Right. Now, do shipwrecks lend themselves to being particularly good ghost stories because of the way people disappear sometimes without a trace?
I would think so.
Going to the blue.
The phrase was, until fairly recently, lost at sea. Mm-hmm. And I think the word lost is, even though it's just four letters, is a very large word. It really unsettles us when there is no explanation for something, when people are lost, when the reason something happened is lost or at least not found. And it's the power of the unsolved mystery. Mm-hmm. It unsettles a reasonable and fact-loving people when all those ends are not tied up. So yes, I think that shipwrecks and people lost at sea, and we got a lot of that on in the lore of our coast, because it's been such a, we have that collection of shoals from Cape Fear and Lookout and the Diamond Shoals and Wimble Shoals above them, you know, where there have been so many wrecks. A lot of relatively unexplained disappearances. Mm-hmm. You know, Theodosia Burr disappeared from the ship the Patriot on her way from South Carolina to New York to see her father, Aaron Burr.
Who was the vice president at that time.
He had been the vice president.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it comes up again and again, and sometimes there's one of these really dramatic stories like the Deering with no crew, and the captain was a very experienced schoonerman, so there's no reason that ship on a fairly calm night, it wasn't a hurricane or a gale should have come in like that.
Mm-hmm. And of course, those shoals off the North Carolina coast are referred to, at least on restaurant placemats across the eastern part of the state, as the graveyard of the Atlantic.
They are indeed, and they're referred to that way, and they are that in fact. And anyone who wants to just visit the interments of ships decade by decade need but go to David Stick's great book, The Graveyard of the Atlantic, mm-hmm. which he wrote as a kind of companion to the Outer Banks of North Carolina. The lore is just full of it.
Right. And there's coming, I believe, a shipwreck museum, too, that would lay out a lot of those stories, too.
We have it. It's up and running out at Hatteras Village. It's the Graveyard of the Atlantic Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And but like we were saying earlier, there's just tons of stories across the state. The Devil's Tramping Ground near here, down Harper's Crossroads near Siler City, where the devil is said to walk at night. And it's a clearing, an unexplained clearing in the woods.
Yeah.
And everybody who goes down there and camps out on it to see if they can see the devil believes he or she is the first one. Probably haven't been but 5,000 people to do that, but we still believe it, you know.
Right, right. Now, Bland Simpson, you've also been involved with some work. You helped to dedicate the University Memorial Grove at the Old Chapel Hill Cemetery. This is the one that's right at the edge of campus. And I understand there's a new trend that's happening at that cemetery, as well as many, many of the old markers that go back a few centuries, a way of burying or spreading the ashes of people there.
Yes, the Memorial Grove is a university holding. It's the grove of trees, oaks, mainly oaks and pines, an acre or so on the east end of or just east of the old Chapel Hill Cemetery, which is a belongs to the town of Chapel Hill now. And the grove, this was an idea set in motion by John Sanders, a very fine, distinguished former director of the Institute of Government, that rather than see that piece of land be turned to some other use, that it could very possibly be a place where cremated remains of people connected with the university, alumni, faculty, staff, family members, where those remains could be buried.
Mm.
So that was what John envisioned most of a decade ago, and that plan has went through all the channels and the property, which is named the University Memorial Grove, was dedicated, has been designed and laid out. It's almost finished with paths and drainage and a wall where the names of the people who are interred there will be displayed. And that was dedicated on University Day, on Founders Day, October 12th.
I wondered, and not to be irreverent here, but I just wonder if the idea of a repository for the remains, the cremains, lends itself to different type of ghost storytelling than, you know, the graveyard where bones are buried, do you think?
It probably does, Melinda, but it may be too early to tell. Although sometimes it is, you know, I walk through the cemetery and see where, you know, the normal grave size plot is the size of a coffin. You'll see there will be a new, apparently individual there who's been kind of placed in where a place where you thought there was no space, and it will be the cremated remains of someone. There are quite a few writers in the Old Chapel Hill Cemetery from generations before and from fairly recently. Paul Green is buried there. And just this past August, our beloved former director here at the writing program, Max Steele, died and is buried there, not 30 feet, I would say, from where Paul and Elizabeth Green are buried.
Well, Bland Simpson, thank you for being with us today, and happy Halloween to you.
Happy haunting, Melinda.
Okay, and to you too. Bland Simpson is a writer and professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a musician with the Red Clay Ramblers and performer with the project King Mackerel and the Blues Are Running. And for today, that's the state of things. If you have a comment about the program, our email address is sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Melinda Pancava, and we go out now with a selection from King Mackerel and the Blues Are Running. Bland Simpson, Don Dixon, and Jim Wan performing the song Make a Light.
Listen, my children. and you shall hear of a wreck on the railroad line. A brakeman lost his life and his head, but his lantern still shines. Now some say it's swamp gas or automobiles explaining that light that appears on the track. But Dr. Hans Holzer says that ghost is real, 'cause he keeps on coming back. In a dismal swamp of East Carolina, 1867, one dark night, a brakeman named Joe Baldwin was riding the coastal line. Quarter to midnight railroad time, the train is pulling into Mako Town. Just a white place along the track for old Joe's lantern to shine. He's shining the Mako light, shining the Mako light. Just a white place along the track, shining the Mako light.
Suddenly Joe feels something wrong. The train slowed down a bit too long. Every brakeman's nightmare, the caboose had gotten loose. The rest of the train had faded up
around. Here come a freight.
Here come a fast freight up from behind. Two lights on a collision course. Will they see old Joe in time? He starts waving the Mako light. Waving the Mako light. Two lights on a collision course, waving the Mako light.
Freight train smashes old Joe's caboose, a kerosene lantern soars in a flash. High above the twisted rails, and burns on in the pines. They found Joe's body, they found Joe's head. They buried them both, but he's not dead.
He's not
on
dead.
A dismal night in a dismal swamp, you can see that lantern shine.
Shining the Mako light, shining the Mako light. On a dismal night in a dismal swamp, shining the Mako light.